Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. A lot of research effort is going into finding the cause of autism, and we seem to be caught in a classic dilemma somewhat, is how much of autism is due to purely genetic issues, how much might be due to environmental influences, or more importantly, we're understanding it's really a little bit of both. My guest today is Dr. Irba Hertz-Picciotto. She is from the University of California, Davis Mind Institute. She's an authority on environmental health effects. She's written over 200 publications on environmental exposures to things such as metals and pesticides and air pollutants and their interactions on humans. And in the last 13, 14 years or so has been somewhat focusing on environmental factors contributing to autism. So the discussion today is really going to revolve around the role of environmental chemicals in autism and perhaps even other neurodevelopmental disorders. Dr. Picciotto, thanks very much for taking the time to be with us today. It's a pleasure to have you joining us by telephone.
Oh, glad to be here.
Those of you who are listening, you can reach us with questions and comments. If you live in Anchorage, our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. You can call us directly at 550-8433. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. So let's start the program in the typical way. I'd like to have you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and what you're doing, and then particularly about the Mind Institute and the purpose of that institute at the University of California, Davis.
Sure. So back in the 1980s, I decided that epidemiology was something I was interested in, and that in particular I wanted to be able to study the environmental chemical exposures that we encounter through daily living and their effects on health. I got my degree. First it was a master's in public health and then a PhD in epidemiology at the University of California at Berkeley. And then I spent maybe 10 years studying environmental chemicals and their effects on pregnancy and on the outcome of the pregnancy, whether it was low birth weight, infant mortality, spontaneous abortion, those sorts of outcomes that might be suboptimal. And I, during that time, I had wanted to be able to then sort of study going forward. And, you know, I think my interest in exposures during the pregnancy period really went back to when I was very young, when I was a child. I had an older brother, and then, you know, when I was about 11, my mother was pregnant again, and it was very exciting for me. So I was really, you know, just totally into, you know, what's going on inside there. You know, and then I had this baby brother, and then shortly after that, the news was filled with these stories about babies that were born absent limbs, legs and arms, and all sorts of other problems, which was traced to the introduction of a medication called thalidomide. And it just really hit me very hard to see, oh, you know, it doesn't always turn out so nicely for the mom and the child. And I think that really, you know, I was very impressionable at that age. So then I became interested really in not just the pregnancy, but I knew that I wanted to follow the birth forward. And in the late 90s, the end of the decade, just around 2000, I was contacted by some people at the University of California at Davis, where the MIND Institute was, you know, very new, just getting started. And MIND stands for the Medical Investigations of Neurodevelopmental Disorders. And there was a group there that wanted to put together a center, meaning a cluster of scientists who are all interested in the topic, and they were interested in looking at autism and environment. And I said, well, I'm sorry, but I don't know anything about autism. And without skipping a beat, the folks at the Mind Institute said, that's not a problem. Nobody really knows very much about it, and we think you can be helpful here. So that was the beginning of what has been a very wonderful, productive, collaborative environment and relationship with colleagues here who also share an interest in looking at neurodevelopment, coming from many other different disciplines than mine, which is epidemiology.
Right. And you've focused, I think it's fair to say, more on the environmental aspects of the epidemiology of the effects on the mind, or on the brain, let's
yeah.
say.
On both.
Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I will say that right from the beginning of this project, I recognized that environment doesn't operate in the vacuum, and neither does genetics, and that if you want to study environmental factors, you also have to take into account genetic susceptibility and mm-hmm. variation. But the issue there is that genetics is kind of hard to change, whereas the environment is something that can be modified, at least in many cases. Sometimes alternatives can be found for kinds of chemicals.
Mm-hmm. We have a number of times on this program, I'm going to kind of follow up on your lead since you led us into genetics here. We've discussed on the program recently and in a number of other programs the explosion of information and withering kind of understanding of the complexities of genetics compared to where we were when the Genome Project all started. And it's gotten to be where it is much, much more complex how our genetic milieu and the environment interact. Do you want to comment on that a little bit?
Well, sure. The first studies about autism and genetics were just looking at family clustering. Does one person in the family have autism increase the risk for the rest of the people simply because they all, they share a large part of their genome? And then we started to develop the ability to actually, map specific genes and do it genome-wide at costs that have been plummeting for the last, decade and a half. And that, opens up then all of, not just the DNA that codes for proteins, but also what we used to think was a lot of junk in there, non-coding regions that actually maybe do something. And now we, in the last, maybe it's 5 years now, not too much longer than that, we have what we call epigenetics, which is recognizing that the DNA, there are lots of things that happen to the DNA other than what's in the core code, and that includes the attachment of various kinds of chemical methyl groups, for example. So we have DNA methylation, which actually controls which genes get expressed, which genes are actually active in producing their proteins, and which do not, or which are being silenced at different times, both in development and in and probably throughout life. There are some genes are coming on more forcefully than others. So, understanding epigenetics and DNA methylation is only one of four or five different kinds of epigenetic marks. It has now been a big part of the picture, and I think we're still really only scratching the surface. But it's very intriguing and provides possible explanations for some of the research findings. And maybe here I'll just take a small little detour and talk a minute about one of our recent studies. We actually published it not so recent now, already several years. In 2011, we showed that mothers who took their prenatal vitamins prior to conception, and I mean the 3 months before they actually conceived and maybe the first month of pregnancy, that time period was critical. If you took the prenatal vitamins at some point during that time period, your chances that the child would develop autism were about 40% lower than women who did not take those prenatal vitamins during that time period. And it's interesting because, you know, later on, we didn't see a difference. In fact, virtually, you know, 80 to 90% to 95% by the time you got to month 2 and 3 of pregnancy were taking those prenatal vitamins. So the critical time period was very early. It actually totally corresponds to the time period that is important for preventing neural tube defects. The whole reason that we recommend that women take those prenatal vitamins and that they take them very early, even before they get pregnant, is that those vitamins, and in particular the folic acid, has an impact on very early brain development, the closure of the primitive brain, the neural tube. And we also found that certain genes made the impact stronger. So if you were a mother who inefficiently absorbed and converted the folic acid to its active form folate, then your chances were the degree to which the folic acid, the prenatal vitamins, helped was even stronger. So it might reduce the risk more than the 40%, maybe 50, 60, 70%. And so how this ties into epigenetics is that the folic acid converts to folate, and the folate has extra methyl groups, chemical, you know, little groups that are critical for neurotransmission. They're critical for DNA, and they're really critical for a lot of biological processes that are important in probably brain development as well as brain functioning.
Let me take 1 second. I want to come back to this because I think this, to me, is just really, really fascinating information, this epigenetics. But I want to remind listeners once again, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Dr. Irva Hertz-Pachotto, and she is an authority on environmental health effects on health, particularly environmental chemicals on autism and neurodevelopmental disorders. If you've got questions or comments, our local number is 550-8433. You can email us during the next hour as well at line1@alaskapublic.org. Back to the genetics. We've known for a long time that our genome has all these genes that code for different things. And back in my time, we thought there was, when I was in training, there was a gene for virtually every protein. Then it became clear in the Genome Project that there's only about 18 to 20,000 genes. And then the question is, well, how in the heck does 18 to 20,000 genes control the hundreds of thousands of proteins that we have? And then things got really complex and realizing that genes kind of connect with each other, and there's parts of genes that are what we call the exons, the part that really code, and they may be mixed together with different genes at different times. And then it got, to me, even more complex, and I think this is where I think you're talking, is that these genes have to get turned on and off for some reason at different times. And it seems like epigenetics has a lot to do with when certain genes may be activated and when they're not. Is that what's happening, we think, with folic acid? If we don't have the right amount of folic acid at the right genetic milieu, then perhaps the gene forgets to get turned on to close the neural canal, for example, or something.
Yeah, probably something like that. I mean, the DNA, the methyl groups actually change how tightly that helix, that double helix, is wound.
Right.
And when it's more tightly wound, then the gene sort of is shut down a bit.
Yeah.
And then as it sort of unwinds, that sort of opens up the space for that gene to actually interact with other molecules. The other thing about the DNA methylation that's interesting is that the embryo, shortly after fertilization, all of the methyl, or most of the methylome, the methyl groups that are attached to the DNA, is actually stripped off, and then a few days or a week later or so, it's reestablished. So something really amazing is happening in the very first week or so of life. And so that actually, I think, has stimulated a lot of interest because, as I say, folate is a major donor of these methyl groups. But exactly what is happening and how that's regulated and why that even happens, I think, is still a little bit of a mystery.
Before we came on the air, we talked about the analogy that I'm much more familiar with than the neurology and the neurobiology, and that's of asthma. And we know, for example, very, very similarly, what happens to women when they're pregnant, maybe up through the first couple of weeks after they deliver, are critical times to perhaps controlling the likelihood of allergy and asthma, which are not necessarily synonymous. And so that one of the more interesting studies is that women who grow up on a farm, the kind of farm where there's lots of animals, and that woman is drinking unpasteurized milk, which gives her a greater exposure to bacteria of certain forms in her intestinal tract, which stimulate her immune system, then the likelihood of that baby having allergy drops considerably, much more so than in almost any other protective factor. So, again, showing that the environmental impacts actually in utero are extremely critical, perhaps for the lifetime of the individual.
Absolutely, and it's interesting you bring up that example about the bacteria, because another really big hot topic these days is the microbiome.
Right.
That our bodies are something like 12 out of 13 million of the cells in our body are not human. So all of these bacteria playing a really critical role that we don't fully understand at all. And that exposure to bacteria and beneficial bacteria are essential to our lives. And also that brings up the issue of the immune system in early life. This is, we haven't fully related this back to what environmental factors are influencing it, but some of my colleagues here at UC Davis are immunologists who have actually found that somewhere about one-fifth maybe of the mothers of children with autism, their immune systems recognize certain proteins from fetal brain tissue, and they make antibodies to those proteins. And we find that very few, much more closer to maybe 1-2% of the mothers of typically developing children are making those kinds of antibodies. So there may be an immunologic kind of sensitivity that is also part of the story of autism causation, but we haven't yet linked that back to what makes certain mothers respond that way. And that may be, again, a combination of some genetics and what other antigens that she's encountered in her lifetime.
Right. Well, let's back up a second. Let's talk about autism. For sure. Let's assume we've got listeners out there not sure what we're talking about. So if you don't mind defining autism, the kinds of symptoms we might see, what we know about when it might present and how we might notice it early and so forth.
Sure. So autism has been characterized as a behavioral syndrome. So there's a set of symptoms that appear. One of them is deficits in social interactions. Another has to do with communication deficits. And then other behavioral patterns, including an insistence on sameness and repetitive either behaviors or very narrow sets of interests, and sometimes some sensory issues as well. Loud noises or touch or textures and things that children will be particularly sensitive to. Some of the early signs would be lack of eye contact, failing to sort of respond to when being spoken to, difficulty with new situations, new places. And there are actually some wonderful websites that one can go to learn, hear the early signs. And at what developmental stages, would you expect to see those? But generally, it appears in the first 3 years of life, often in the second year, although there are some children who will begin to exhibit some of these signs in the first year of life. But by the end of the third year of life, a definitive diagnosis can certainly be made.
And I would just mention those who are listening who'd like to go to some of those sites to see some of the more specific signs and things that might trigger the idea of autism. At our website, alaskapublic.org, if you go to the Line 1 link on today's program, you'll see two sites, Autism Speaks and the Center for Disease Control, which both have some much more information about the specifics of diagnosing or the early signs of autism. Does it seem to so the presentation is often early. The natural history of autism is what? What happens with a typical patient with autism over time?
It's considered to be a lifelong condition, although there do appear to be some people who, quote-unquote, outgrow it. There are periods that may be more difficult than others, and I think those early years, most parents will say, were the most difficult, that sometimes it takes a child some period of time to develop their system of communication, and it might be an atypical system. There are some kids who don't talk, but they can communicate through, some of our new technologies involving keyboards and that sort of thing. And by, late childhood, some of the most difficult sorts of symptoms of often a lot of screaming and tantrums and that sort of thing may, begin to resolve. Adults with autism can range. There's a great range in ability to sort of function and attend school and learn and so forth. So there are some children who are quite cognitively impaired in addition to having autism, but there are many others who are not particularly impaired, and some who are really quite brilliant. And there are certainly many people who have gotten PhDs who might have been classified as autism if they'd been seen by the right clinician. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, the life course, there are ups and downs, but by and large, the kind of core symptoms are often there for the full lifetime.
Okay, how about sex differences, ethnic differences? That kind
sure.
of issue.
Yeah.
What do we know?
Yeah. The descriptive epidemiology, that
right.
we call it. It does affect males much more than females. It's about 4-1. That's the ratio. It might vary from study to study a little bit, sometimes a little lower, sometimes a little higher. But by and large, I think the 4-1 is probably the best statistic on that. As far as race and ethnic differences, So one of the issues is whether we are finding all of the kids and properly diagnosing all of them. And I think there has been data suggesting that in some periods of time where it appeared that it was mostly in white and more educated families. However, I think that is starting to be seen less and less as the ability to diagnose has become, there are a lot more clinicians now who have mm-hmm. that training mm-hmm. and are attuned to looking for those symptoms
right.
than there were, say, 15 years ago. So I think, you know, what often happens is in the beginning of this kind of a situation where it is not necessarily every physician or every pediatrician who would have recognized it, that it would be seen more in communities that have better access to the facilities, the healthcare facilities,
right,
and the clinicians. But by and large, there's not much. There are a few clusters. There has been an unusually high rate seen in the Somali immigrant population, and that is being studied. It seems to be mostly not discriminatory. And it's found worldwide. So.
Okay. One last question, which is kind of leading me to the issue of, to be honest, is are we really seeing more, or is it some kind of a bias in the way we're looking at the information? And that question is, how long has this diagnosis of autism been around? How did we first think of it, and what has changed about the awareness of this syndrome, a collection of symptoms that have led to different diagnostic criteria, let's say?
So the first report that actually defined it was published in, I believe it was 1943, by a psychiatrist named Leo Kanner, K-A-N-N-E-R. And he described 11 cases that he had been treating. And he described in great detail each of these individuals and their symptoms and how the families reacted and so forth. The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is abbreviated DSM, that catalogs mental health conditions, has had several different versions, and the definition of autism, you know, I don't know exactly when it went into the DSM, but in the early 1990s, they were on version 3, you know, in the 80s. Version 4 came out in the early 90s, and it sort of expanded the definition a little bit. So there was an increase in diagnosed cases, in part because that definition actually changed. And I've heard several, and I've read several different studies that have come up with different estimates of how that changed the rates. But it may have doubled them approximately. And then we just recently came out with another change to go to the DSM-5. And most people are saying it, and there are some changes, but was that accompanied by an increase, or were some people actually cut out from the definition? I think there's a lot of debate about that. I am not sure that the jury is in yet on the bottom line. Did that change things? However, the rates of autism have been going up rather steadily for quite a while, and if you look at papers in the 1970s and 1980s and the 1990s, they did begin to climb more rapidly, it appears, in the 1990s. And in California, it's been about 15% increase per year steadily, and I am getting ready to look at the data for the last 3 or 4 years, but up until a few years ago, that had held all the way from, say, the 1990 births all the way up until, you know, the 2000, early 2000 births.
And it appears now, based on the most recent kind of epidemiologic studies, it's one of the very common disorder, much more common than a lot of other disorders we think about and hear about.
It's about 1 in 68, the best estimates coming out of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Yeah. And that's been down, you know, 2 years before that it was 1 in 110 or actually, it was 1 in 90, and then 2 years before that was 1 in 110, 2 years before that was 1 in 150. So definitely it's been getting more prevalent. And certainly at some point we are hoping it will plateau and start to go down, and part of my motivation for doing this research is to figure out what we can do to actually reduce those rates.
Well, I want to get to that. I've spent a lot of time trying to get some basic information underground and on the ground. And so what I'd like to do now is take our typical 1 minute break. I want to remind listeners, this is Line 1, your health connection, our local number, 550-8433, our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a short break and we'll continue our discussion. And I promise we'll get into the environmental chemical aspects on neurodevelopmental disorders and autism with our guest, Dr. Irva Hertz-Pichotto. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection, originating from KSKA, the Anchorage NPR affiliate. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Dr. Irva Hertz-Pichotto. She's epidemiologist specializing in environmental effects on health. She's currently working at the University of California Davis Mind Institute. Up to this point, we've been talking in general about autism, some of the epidemiology, we call it, who, when, where, how, what we know about autism. And we're going to now focus a lot more on potential environmental triggers that may act in concert or independently with our genetic system to lead to autism and neurodevelopmental disorders. You can email questions to us during the next 30 minutes or so at line1@alaskapublic.org, our local number 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And please remember, you can go to alaskapublic.org, look for the Line 1 link and look at our archive and listen to this program later this afternoon, tomorrow, or anytime in the future, or perhaps even refer somebody you'd like to have listen to the program. You can do that at any time. Dr. Pichotto, let's kind of jump to your studies in particular and tell us what led to the studies and how they were designed, and then hopefully we can get some discussion about what your findings are.
Sure, yes. So I mentioned earlier in the program that in around 2000, I got together with a group here at the UC Davis Mind Institute to submit a grant to get a center started, and we got that award. And as part of that center, and also with lots of support from the Mind Institute, we were able to start a large study called the CHARGE study, which stands for Childhood Autism Risks from Genes and Environment. This is a study that we call case control, and what that means is that we assemble a bunch of people who have the condition of interest, the cases, and then we assemble a group that is comparable, and in this case we match them on age, on gender, and on the general larger geography of where they came from, of children who do not have the condition that you're concerned about, and we call those the controls. And in this study, we actually used three groups. We used cases with autism. We also have a second case group, which is children with other types of developmental delay but not autism. And then the third group were the controls, who we wanted to get as random a selection from the population. We wanted to really kind of represent the background of people, of exposures, children in the age group, which was 2 to 5 years, that exists, that is out there among people who don't have autism. And so we started with birth certificate files of birth certificates, and just randomly selected with those criteria that we were matching the age and the gender and the geography, and then brought them into the clinic at the Mind, and we confirmed every diagnosis was every child was actually examined by our clinicians who are reliable and well-trained to administer all these instruments for diagnosing autism and for assessing cognitive development and adaptive skills, which are kind of like daily functioning skills, and, you know, how well can the child, you know, dress themselves and eat, you know, feed themselves and so forth. So that was the beginning of the study. We started recruiting in 2003, and by now we have you know, well over 1,000, getting closer to 2,000 families that have been enrolled. We collected lots of specimens as well from the child and from the family members, and we've been able to measure various things. So findings that we've had, as Dr. Wither mentioned, we have many findings that we've published, and some of the ones that we've recently published, in fact, is a paper on pesticides. And so there's actually now 3 different papers, our group and 2 other groups, that have seen associations between pesticide exposures and the development of autism. And we were looking at families that lived near where agricultural applications of pesticides had been applied. And those who lived closer to those applications were more likely to have a child who developed autism for specific chemical classes. So pesticides is a very, very broad term. They come in different chemical classes, and we saw several chemical classes that were associated with higher risk of autism. We also found, by the way, that there were some associations with the developmental delay group, that second case group that I mentioned. So, and this has been true for some of our other findings, that it's not just autism, but other types of developmental delay are often affected by some of the same environmental risk factors.
And when we're trying to, again, you said this was a case control study, so it's really what we would say is a classification of an observational study. It's hard to absolutely get cause and effect, but we notice associations, which you've used carefully with this description. So these are things that seem to be associated and then may lead us to more specific evaluations to see if we can really pin down cause and effect, for example. But one of the criteria would be, you know, to look at this would be, do we have a potential mechanism that might explain why early exposures to pesticides could do what we're seeing in the symptoms of autism?
Yeah. No, that's a really good point, that in an observational study, there could be all sorts of other things that are going on that make it appear that, you know, these two are associated, but it's not an actual cause and effect. So, you know, one of the things we do is we try and look at a lot of other things that are causes, known causes or suspected causes, and we, you know, try to, you know, what we do is we statistically control. We try to make sure that we're really comparing apples with apples, and you know, if you've got people who are, you know, getting good nutrition and other people who are getting bad nutrition, you don't want the nutrition to be, you know, associated with the pesticide exposures, because that would you know, mix things up, what we call confounding. So so we did a lot of that. We did try to control for a lot of other things in this. And then we have to ask, so is there a good mechanism? And so when you think about pesticides, the interesting thing about, and even why they're high on my list for chemicals to look at, is that many of these pesticides are actually designed to influence and basically shut down the central nervous system. Some of them are designed to do that in insects, or rodents, or, you know, that sort of thing, rather than necessarily being designed to do it in humans. But it does mean that they are affecting the kinds of tissue that goes into our brain. And we often find that pesticides do cause impacts in mammals and There are reports of dogs being poisoned when people spray around their mm-hmm. homes, for example. Mm-hmm. We also know specific mechanisms that certain kinds of chemicals have. And the interesting thing about the three studies on pesticides is that they were looking at some overlapping and some different pesticides. So the very first study that came out was looking at pesticides that were used very extensively in the in the 1950s, for example, quite a while ago, called organochlorines. And the problem with organochlorines, besides that they affected wildlife and they actually weakened the shells of bird eggs, for example, is that they last for a very, very long time. They're highly persistent. They're persistent in the environment and they're persistent in the human body. And even people who have lived in areas where no spraying of any of those kinds of pesticides has ever happened, we can detect those organochlorine pesticides in their blood. The second kind of pesticide that was then studied in the second study were the organophosphates, and they were designed to be much more short-lived precisely because of all the concern raised about the organochlorines, which actually was written up in that popular book written by Rachel Carson called Silent Spring. Her book was a lot about the organochlorines. But then the organophosphates were supposed to improve things because they're so short-lived. But they're still toxic, and maybe in some ways they're more toxic. They have to deliver the toxic dose in a shorter time before they decompose and are metabolized to less toxic chemicals. And then another class that, in fact, organophosphates have now been banned for household product use. They're still used, however, in agriculture, and that still raises concerns, and also they're being replaced for many of the household products with what are called the pyrethroids, and the pyrethroids are this newest class of chemicals. If you look at what they say on the packages, they talk about being natural, and that's because the original pyrethrin is naturally occurring in the chrysanthemum plant, but the pyrethroids, as Oid tells us, have been synthetically, designed to be actually more toxic and last longer than the pyrethrins, and so they are not naturally occurring. And they also affect the central nervous system. They act on what are called the voltage-sensitive sodium channels in the cells, and they actually cause neurons to continually fire and not close down after they've had the electrical impulse.
So there's clearly some neurologic mechanisms with which these chemicals could affect the brain. And then we get into this complexity we've hinted at before, is that perhaps an exposure at one time of a person's life when they're 10 may lead to a different group of symptoms than when they're exposed in utero as that nervous system is developing. So that timing as well as quantity can be important. Findings in your charge study related to those things.
Exactly, yeah. We tended to see definitely in pregnancy, it's a little harder sometimes to pin these things down exactly when in pregnancy, but we saw effects both late in pregnancy and other time points as well. So, and of course, we were going by when was the application done in the agricultural field, but it might be applied, and then there's drift due to wind and weather patterns and so forth. So by the time the person actually gets exposed, it could be a few weeks or month or so later even. So that makes it hard to do these studies to look at timing. But I think that there are certainly biological reasons to believe that these could be developmentally toxic to the brain in that period of gestation. So further work is needed. Our findings related to both organophosphates and pyrethroids, I think more studies need to be conducted to really confirm these findings. But you know, many studies have actually now looked at organophosphates in relation to cognitive impairment and general intellectual disability, and children score more poorly who were exposed. Some of those studies had measures of urinary metabolites of the organophosphates, and that's, in other words, really measuring it in the body and not just were you living near an application. Mm-hmm. So, we, you know, which improves on, then we can say for sure we know there was an exposure.
Yeah, I'm sure you've controlled for this, but I'm thinking you did all this study in California where there's a large agricultural economy, and then there's people who have very little exposure to that in that
sure.
kind of economy,
yeah.
and that's looked at and controlled for.
Right, yeah, and so we need to think about other routes of exposure for pesticides. So the average person who doesn't live near an agricultural field is getting their pesticides from eating produce that's been sprayed. Some of the residues last for a while. Some of them get actually incorporated into the, you know, fruit or vegetable. And then there's household applications. So while the organophosphates are now not being sold for those household products, the pyrethroids are, and then there are other products that are also on the market. Imidacloprid is used in, you know, flea and tick applications for pets. And then, you know, those chemicals, if you've got an indoor pet, they get spread around your house. So, you know, pesticides are in our environment, in the food and in often in the households, you know, different times of the year. So even if you're not living near agricultural fields, you may be getting doses and we are actually looking at some of the household household applications as well, we have to look at the total
right.
picture
right.
of these things. By the way, there's a fourth thing, although it's a very small use relative to those other three routes of exposure, which is what they call public health applications, and in order to fight the West Nile virus that may not have made it up to Alaska, but
right.
has been in pretty the contiguous states. West Nile virus has definitely, you know, moved into many, many states now, and there were aerial sprayings in you know, certain communities where the infestation seemed to be quite it seems to have really taken hold in California, and they're using, you know, organophosphates and pyrethroids, and I understand that our county was sprayed with pyrethroids, but some other counties were sprayed with organophosphates because the mosquitoes were developing resistance to the pyrethroids.
Mm-hmm.
So
yep.
we get into these cycles, you know,
right.
we replace one toxic chemical with another one, and, you know, then we wait until we gather enough evidence before we move on to the next one. And you know, I would say that the pest control industry has responded to the need for more integrated pest management practices that utilize less of the toxic chemicals and rely on other ways to control those pests.
It's my understanding that you've also got another study going, looking at the issue of autism and genetics and environment in a slightly different mechanism, where you're following mothers who've had a previous child with autism. Am I right about that?
Yeah. And then that's actually part of the way we try to address, for example, when we have studies where people reported what they took, as in the folic acid, you know, did you take your prenatal vitamins question was asked of the mothers, and then you have to worry, well, are they remembering differently if they've got a child who's got autism? So to get around that, we do what we call a prospective study where, yes, we enroll these families where the mother, you know, where there's a high risk that one of her children will develop autism, high relative to that 1 in 68. So if there's one child in the family with autism, it maybe is as high as 1 in 5, you know, somewhere around 18 to 20% risk for the younger sibling. And so those are the mothers we recruit. They have a child with autism already, and they're getting pregnant. And then we can collect a lot of information in real time, including, you know, actual specimens to say, oh, well, what kind of nutrients did she have circulating in her body, and are there any markers of pesticide exposures or air pollutants or, you know, who knows, solvents or, you know, other things that haven't yet been really looked at, phthalates and plasticizers and so forth. Mm-hmm. And that study, yeah, we're in the field. We have about 150 children have now graduated, meaning they we have a final diagnosis at 36 months. We're hitting at about 18 to 20% who are being diagnosed with autism, and we're just beginning to analyze those data. So, you know, I can't tell you the results yet, but in the next few years we will be, you know, we expect to be publishing. We want to look at things, some of the things we've already looked at in the case control study, and see if using the most objective measures possible, like pesticide metabolites in their urine, in the mom's urine, beginning in, you know, first and second and third trimesters, and does that correlate with which child got autism or not? So it's still observational. We're not conducting experiments. We're not taking people and saying, okay, you got assigned to the pesticide use group and you got assigned to the clean, you know, whatever.
some studies get ethical and hard to
in
do.
Environmental sciences, it's hard to do things that, you know, an experiment that's going to be ethical. And maybe you can remove exposures sometimes, but, you know, it's often hard.
We've got a couple of callers who've come in, and we've only got a couple of minutes left, so let's see if we can help them. Robin, you're on line one. What question do you have for us?
Yeah, about a year ago, I was diagnosed with the MTHFR gene mutation, and that mutation deals with the methyl cycle, which you spoke about earlier. And in my research, I found that there's often a link with autism with people that have this gene mutation. And I was just wondering if you were familiar with Dr. Amy Yasko, who has done a protocol for autism and her study in gene disorders and how different gene mutations may play a part in autism.
I'm not familiar with her work specifically. A lot of the genetics work, you know, there's been a lot, and many rare mutations have been examined and have been found to sort of rise to the top as distinguishing kids with autism from kids without. To date, I had not seen any of those studies picking up on the MTHFR gene. Our study did find that the mothers who, either the mother or the child who had the inefficient form of that gene, the child was at higher risk for having autism. But the biggest effect, but that was actually a small effect if the mother took her prenatal vitamins early in, as I said, before she became pregnant or in the first month of pregnancy. So it turns out, though, that taking the, you know, these large doses that are contained in the prenatal vitamins of folic acid and possibly some of the other things that are in those prenatal vitamins, such as, you know, iron and other B vitamins, had a huge impact in basically countering the increased risk by a huge amount. So bringing their risks to, you know, maybe less than a woman who doesn't have that mutation and then didn't take the prenatal vitamins. So taking prenatal vitamins, if you're thinking of having children, and making sure you start taking them, probably start 3 months before you're planning to get pregnant, because that it takes a little while for the folate to build up, and if you're not metabolizing very, very rapidly, you may need more time.
All right. Thanks for your call, Robin.
Okay, thanks.
All righty. We only have a couple of minutes left. There's another caller, but I really want you, if you don't mind, and I hate to not have the caller have her questions answered, but I want to address and ask you specifically if you would put some perspective, as you understand it right now, of the evidence suggesting that environmental chemicals can have an effect on neurodevelopmental disorders, and particularly autism. What's your gestalt? How much of an issue is this?
Well, I think it would be surprising if they didn't. We know that, you know, things don't, you know, you can call it chance, but when we see patterns and we see relationships, you know, and we think about the biology, there's every reason to think that it's, you know, the brain needs a lot of needs a nice intrauterine environment and postnatal environment to develop properly. There are so many things that can go wrong, and how the synapses are formed and how the neurons begin to synchronize in their responses to the environment really starts to happen prenatally. And there's some really interesting imaging work showing that, you know, by the third trimester, neurons are starting to kind of work together in fetal brains, and we know that environmental chemicals can affect, and we design drugs that affect how neurons function and how the synapses, you know, respond. So we know. I mean, there's no doubt that those things can be influenced. The question is which environmental factors and how much, and where should we really be putting our efforts in terms of prevention?
Mm-hmm.
So, air pollution, metals, pesticides, some of the endocrine disrupting compounds that don't fall into any of those other categories. You know, have been studied, sometimes some of them in relation to ADHD, some of them in relation to autism, some of them in relation to intellectual disability. So there are influences. We need to put a lot more of our funding into studying them, and the balance of funding at NIH on autism has largely been the genetics over the environment by somewhere around 20-fold higher. So, you know, talk to your congresspeople.
Yep.
And we can figure it out.
Money always somehow gets involved.
yeah. Well, it's expensive to do a really good, robust, rigorous study. So
it is. All right. Well, I have to apologize that we had one more caller. We're just not going to get time to get to. I want to say my personal thanks for taking the time to be with us for such a long period of time this afternoon and to give us so much information. I really appreciate it, Dr. Picciotto.
Well, I hope that was helpful. Thank you very much for having me.
You have a good day. If you want to continue the conversation on environmental chemicals and autism, you can join KSKA on Facebook, and you find that link at www.alaskapublic.org. In 1610, Shakespeare said, "We are stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep." Next week, we're going to see what Dr. Ross Dodge, an Anchorage sleep specialist, has to say about sleep and sleep disorders. So join us next Monday at 2 p.m. on KSKA. Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Evan Erickson was our web editor and audio engineer. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.